United Press International presents 1968 in Review, a documentary in words and sounds of some of the events and the people who were the newsmakers during 1968. The depth and diversity of the news events of 1968 were astonishing. For some, it was a year of violence and dissent. For others, a year of victory and joy. But no matter how the year affected you, there is little doubt that you'll soon forget the year 1968. For Americans, 1968 was, above all, a political year. And for politician Richard Milhouse Nixon, it was the most important year of his life.
As you probably have heard, have received a very gracious message from the Vice President congratulating me for winning the election. I congratulated him for his gallant and courageous fight against great odds. I also told him that I know exactly how he felt. I know how it feels to lose a close one.
For Hubert Horatio Humphrey, it was a year that was difficult to assess.
I have done my best. I have lost. Mr. Nixon has won. The democratic process has worked its will. So now let's get on with the urgent task of uniting our country. Thank you.
The United Press International 1968 in Review will continue with the story of the conventions, candidates, and campaigns right after this message. After picking up a string of victories in primary elections throughout the country, the Republican Party's national convention in Miami, Florida, seemed to be Richard Nixon's show from the start, and it was. The voting wasn't close as many predicted it would be, and Nixon won the nomination in the first ballot.
Wisconsin!
It was Wisconsin which put Nixon over the top.
To cast its 30 votes for the nominee of this convention, Richard M. Nixon.
So for the Republicans, the race was on. To the degree that the Republican convention was bland and undramatic, the Democratic convention made up for it with vivid and at times unbelievable drama inside and outside the convention hall. Just days before the convention began, the city of Chicago, in some respects, did not appear ready to handle the convention. Cab drivers were threatening a strike, the telephone company and public transit workers were already out on strike, and added to that, anti-war groups and yippies had announced they were coming to Chicago to demonstrate against the war in Vietnam and against the Democratic Party. To prepare for this eventuality, Chicago had 5,000 National Guardsmen on duty, and the Chicago City Police Force was reinforced. Inside the convention hall, delegates defeated a move to put a dovish Vietnam resolution into the party platform. Instead, the platform stayed essentially the way Hubert Humphrey had wanted it. For Eugene McCarthy, Humphrey's strongest competitor, it was a large defeat that made it obvious that Humphrey and the Democratic machine were in charge. The McCarthy phenomenon, born with a near victory over Lyndon Johnson in the New Hampshire primary and nurtured with a following of young blood, was dead. And as the convention reached its peak with the nomination of Humphrey, the clash between Chicago police and the demonstrators erupted.
One cop picked up a demonstrator and tossed him into the down the steps of the subway system.
Hey, you pig! Go run!
Here they come. They're charging into it. They're just swinging into this crowd. They're pushing the crowd. It's a stampede.
There goes a big blast of tear gas. I can't see. He got me in the face. Oh, man.
Just hang on. Don't rub it, man. It makes it worse. You rub it in.
I can't see you. Where am I?
Hanging on to me, and I can see fine.
The confrontations were violent and frequent. Mayor Richard Daley and the Chicago police were criticized for their handling of the situation on one hand and strongly supported on the other. But the aftermath left a stain on the Democratic Party's image that Humphrey would try to erase during the campaign.
This moment is one of personal pride and gratification. Yet one cannot help but reflect the deep sadness that we feel over the troubles and the violence which have erupted regrettably and tragically in the streets of this great city. Surely we have now learned the lesson that violence breeds counter-violence, and it cannot be condoned, whatever the source.
But the American presidential race of 1968 was not settled with the emergence of Humphrey and Nixon from their respective conventions. George Corley Wallace, former governor of Alabama, segregationist and purveyor of states' rights politics, entered his name as the presidential candidate for the American Independent Party. Wallace's campaign techniques were based largely on an appeal for law and order. He made the appeal to the so-called common man, the working-class person who, according to him, was offered no choice in Nixon and Humphrey. Wallace berated the press, the polls, intellectuals, liberals, and establishment, and the hippies and hecklers who seemed to follow him everywhere he went. His call for law and order was repeated in every speech.
I can tell you that if I were the president of the United States, you could walk on the streets in any section of Washington, D.C. at any time, and I would make that possible if I had to bring 30,000 troops to Washington and put one every 30 feet with a 2-foot bayonet on the end of a rifle. We're going to make it safe for all the citizens of Washington, D.C., because it's a sad commentary that in the nation's capital, you're fearful of walking out of this hotel.
But in American elections, the people have the final say with the ballot. And on November the 5th, Richard M. Nixon was elected president in a surprisingly close vote.
I saw many signs in this campaign. Some of them were not friendly. Some were very friendly. But the one that touched me the most was one that I saw in Destler, Ohio, at the end of a long day of whistle stopping. A little town, I suppose five times the population was there in the dusk. It was almost impossible to see, but a teenager held up a sign, "Bring us together." And that will be the great objective of this administration at the outset, to bring the American people together.
The outcome of the election was affected by many events. Two of those events, two of the most poignant in American history, were the assassinations of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Senator Robert Kennedy. The United Press International looks back at those tragic stories on 1968 in review.
I am announcing today my candidacy for the presidency of the United States.
After Eugene McCarthy's show of strength in the New Hampshire primary, Senator Robert F. Kennedy reassessed his position and entered the 1968 race for president. The Kennedy announcement was a political surprise, but it was overshadowed 15 days later when another man informed the country of his decision regarding the presidency.
I do not believe that I should devote an hour or a day of my time to any personal partisan causes. Accordingly, I shall not seek and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
Uplifted by the Johnson announcement, Robert Kennedy set out to make 1968 his most trying year, a year during which he hoped to become the next president of the United States, but a year that for him ended in death.
Senator Kennedy has been shot. Is that possible? Is that possible? Is it possible, ladies and gentlemen? It is possible. He has. Not only Senator Kennedy. Oh, my God. Senator Kennedy has been shot. And another man, a Kennedy campaign manager, and possibly shot in the head. I am right here. Rafer Johnson has a hold of a man who apparently has fired the shot.
United Press International's review of the news of 1968 will continue after this message. Radio newsman Andrew West was covering the California primary for the Mutual Broadcasting System. He was following Senator Kennedy out of the ballroom of the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. The senator exited the hotel through the kitchen. Andrew West followed. He heard the shots and instinctively turned on his tape recorder.
He still has the gun. The gun is pointed at me right at this moment. I hope they can get the gun out of his hand. Be very careful. Get the gun. Get the gun. Get the gun. Stay away from the gun.
Get the gun.
Stay away from the gun. His hand is frozen. Get his thumb. Get his thumb. Get his thumb.
Get his hand.
Take a hold of his thumb and break it if you have to. Get his thumb. Now look. Get away from the barrel. Get away from the barrel, man. That's it, Raper. Get it. Get the gun, Raper. Okay, now hold on to the guy. Hold on to him. Hold on to him, ladies and gentlemen. They have the gun away from the man. In this shot. They've got the gun. I can't see the man. I can't see who it is. But Senator Kennedy right now is on the ground. He has been shot. I do not know if the senator is dead or if he is alive.
The next day, the senator's press secretary informed a stunned nation of Kennedy's death.
Senator Robert Francis Kennedy died at 1:44 a.m. today, June 6, 1968. He was 42 years old.
The streets of New York were filled with mourners. Thousands and thousands passed to touch his casket, which lay in state at St. Patrick's Cathedral. They came and they waited for hours to pay their final respect.
I feel a very deep emotion today. Mr. Kennedy was... I really can't talk. I'm sorry.
You may be in this line for quite some time. Does that upset you terribly?
Oh, no. It took me close to 14 years to become an American citizen. And he was a big inspiration in it for me and my sister. I'm sorry.
Ted Kennedy, the last surviving son of Mr. and Mrs. Joseph Kennedy, eulogized his brother.
Those of us who loved him and who take him to his rest today pray that what he was to us, what he wished for others, will someday come to pass for all the world. As he said many times in many parts of this nation, to those he touched and who sought to touch him, some men see things as they are and say why. I dream things that never were and say why not.
As the body of Senator Kennedy was carried out, singer Andy Williams filled the cathedral with the sound of a hymn that was relevant and stirring. Soon the crowd of mourners joined spontaneously, and the great room was heavy with song. And at Arlington National Cemetery, Robert Kennedy's body was lowered into a grave. And there, a few feet away, a flickering yellow flame marked the gravesite of his brother, the late President John Fitzgerald Kennedy, whose life, too, was ended with an assassin's bullet. One assassination is one too many for any country. But for America in 1968, there were two. On April the 5th, 1968, another leader of American people was shot.
Is any of you around when I have to meet my day? I don't want a long funeral. And if you get somebody to deliver the eulogy, tell them not to talk too long. And every now and then I wonder what I want them to say. Tell them not to mention that I have a Nobel Peace Prize. That isn't important. tell them not to mention that I have 300 or 400 other awards. That's not important. Tell them not to mention where I went to school. I'd like somebody to mention that day that Martin Luther King Jr. tried to give his life serving others. I'd like for somebody to say that day that Martin Luther King Jr. tried to love somebody. I want you to say that day that I tried to be right on the war question. I want you to be able to say that day that I did try to feed the hungry. I want you to be able to say that day that I did try in my life to clothe those who were naked. I want you to say on that day that I did try in my life to visit those who were in prison. I want you to say that I tried to love and serve humanity. Yes, if you want to say that I was a drum major, say that I was a drum major for justice. Say that I was a drum major for peace. I was a drum major for righteousness. And all of the other shallow things will not matter.
The story of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is next on United Press International's 1968 in Review.
I got into Memphis, and some began to say the threat, or talk about the threat that were out. What would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers? Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now. Because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind.
Some say that Dr. Martin Luther King had a premonition about his death. Certainly he thought about it, and on the night of April the 4th, 1968, it came.
I was standing down on the ground floor, looking up at him as he came out of his room, and we were talking, as I was talking to the ground, he was upstairs, and all at once, which I now know to be a shot, but sounded like a firecracker. And I turned around behind me, and I turned around again. I saw him laying down, and then I ran out in the street to see whether or not there was a car out there.
You're listening to United Press International's 1968 in Review. This program will continue right after this message. The assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. struck the nation with intense concern. Political leaders such as Senator Howard Baker of Tennessee called for restraint.
I very much hope that the rumors that there have been extensive gun purchases are exaggerated, but if they're true, I also very much hope that this would be an example of futility of violence, whether by white or by black, and that we do not have a repetition of Detroit, of Watts, of any other unpleasant incident on the social evolutionary scale of American development, and that this terrible sacrifice by Dr. King may be the touchstone by which this nation grabs hold of its wits and realizes that we have a great job ahead of us, but that it's not an impossible task and that we can accomplish it in brotherhood.
Most black leaders called for nonviolent action in the wake of King's death. James Farmer was one.
Dr. King would be greatly distressed to find that his blood had triggered off some bloodshed and disorder, because that is, it runs counter to his entire life. I think instead the nation should be quiet, black and white, and we should be in a prayerful mood, which would be in keeping with his life, and we should make that kind of dedication and commitment to the goals which his life served, to solving the domestic problems. And that's the memorial. That's the kind of memorial we should build for him. It's just not appropriate for there to be violent retaliations and that kind of demonstration in the wake of the murder of this pacifist and man of peace.
But Stokely Carmichael was angry.
About America killed Dr. King last night. She made
a whole lot easier for a whole lot of black people today. There no longer needs to be intellectual discussions. Black people know that they have to get guns. White America will live to cry that she killed Dr. King last night. It would have been better if she had killed Rat Brown and or Stokely Carmichael. But when she killed Dr. King, she lost.
Maybe it was frustration, maybe hate, perhaps vengeance. But whatever the cause, black persons in many cities, in Chicago and Boston and Detroit and Washington, took their fury to the streets. Reason was gone, and looting, arson, and terror took over.
Federal troops in combat dress have surrounded the White House and the Capitol building as racial violence continues here. As bands of Negroes roam the streets, a machine gun post was set up on Capitol Hill. Despite an emergency curfew, Negroes continue to loot at will in the downtown section, some of the trouble just three blocks from the White House. Black smoke can be seen billowing into the air in many parts of Northwest Washington, the result of dozens of arson cases. Police have occasionally fired tear gas in attempts to halt bands of looters. In several instances, officers held looters at bay with shotguns. This is Bill Greenwood in Washington.
Before the smoke had cleared and the sirens had stopped, the funeral of civil rights leader Martin Luther King was held. His plain oak coffin was carried through the streets of Atlanta, Georgia, on a wooden cart drawn by two mules. At the church services, a song so closely associated with the civil rights movement and Martin Luther King sprang from the crowd. They sang for a man they revered.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome.
Dr. King's death came after he had made plans for a massive poor people's march on the Capitol. His death did not diminish those plans, and in May, 50,000 persons made Resurrection City their home. It was a community of makeshift wooden homes and tents that presented a stark contrast to the majestic marble buildings of Washington. There the poor, the black, the Indian, the Mexican, slept, ate, and demonstrated. A report by the President's Commission to Study Riots was issued in March. Chairman Otto Kerner told of one of the conclusions of the report.
Our nation is moving toward two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal. Reaction to last summer's disorders has quickened the movement and deepened the division. Discrimination and segregation have long permeated much of American life. They now threaten the future of every American. This deepening racial division is not inevitable. The movement apart can be reversed. Choice is still possible. Our principal task is to define that choice and to press for a national resolution.
And while racial strife was a part of 1968, there was also news of progress toward achieving justice for all races. The Civil Rights Bill, passed in 1968, is designed to topple racial barriers in 80% of the nation's housing.
Today, the nation's Congress passed the Civil Rights Act of 1968. And this is a victory for every American, because the only true path to progress for a free people is the one that we will take when this legislation is made the law of our land. Through the process of law, we shall strike for all time the shackles of an old injustice.
The poor weren't the only ones who demonstrated in 1968. By far more frequent and more vehement demonstrators were students in Paris, in New York City, Mexico, Poland, Egypt, West Germany, and Czechoslovakia. The story of student unrest, student dissent, student takeover, coming up next on United Press International's 1968 in Review.
Peace!
sound in 1968, the sound of students. In no other year in recent history has student unrest, student demonstrations, or student power been so apparent as in 1968. The collective voice of students on campuses has been growing each year during this decade. And during 1968, once again, it was the voice of college students that was heard around the world. One of the first meaningful and significant displays of student dissent was at Columbia University in New York City. There, students, led by groups such as the Students for a Democratic Society, forced the university to close its classrooms while students occupied university buildings to dramatize their disgust with university policy. Mark Rudd, head of the Columbia chapter of SDS, told what the student demands were.
All disciplinary action now pending and probations already imposed upon six students be immediately terminated and a general amnesty be granted to those participating in this demonstration. The construction of the Columbia Gym in Morningside Park cease at once. Three. President Kirk's ban on demonstrations inside university buildings be dropped.
United Press International's News of the Year 1968 will continue after this message. The student action that seemed to have the most far-reaching effect on a country and the world occurred in Paris. Paris in the spring was not the place to be during 1968. Students struck the Sorbonne in May, demanding that the famous old school change its educational policies. The student strike seemed to be the catalyst for a nationwide strike of workers that eventually affected everyone in France. By the time French President Charles de Gaulle had cleared the situation, millions of workers were out of work. The climax of the French student dissent came when students and Paris police clashed.
Tear gas shells are going off now. The explosions you hear are bangers. The police forced back the demonstrators. The students are throwing rocks, flying with tear gas shells, noisemakers, and throwing the rocks back in some cases. The two sides have been facing each other here for nearly 2 hours at the bridge on the left bank of the Seine. Now the fire trucks are moving in, trying to clean the streets. Police ahead of them, the fire truck. The water is going on now. Water and tear gas breaking up a whole section of the crowd.
In Rome, a student demonstration eventually spread throughout the country. The cities of Turin, Naples, and Florence had bands of demonstrating students fighting with police with words, fists, and clubs. Just before the Summer Olympics were to begin in Mexico City, it was students who fought with Mexican police and with the army. They, too, were demanding the university's reform to meet student requests. The demonstrations in Mexico City, as in other cities, turned bloody. An estimated 100 were killed, hundreds hurt, and thousands arrested. If there was a college in the United States where there wasn't a demonstration of some sort, it was in the minority. Young people demonstrated against U.S. policy in Vietnam, against the draft, civil rights, and the way the schools were being run. But dissent was not limited solely to the young. Adults participated, too. Singer Eartha Kitt shocked a White House luncheon sponsored by Mrs. Johnson when she rose from the luncheon table and attacked the United States' involvement in Vietnam and the growth of juvenile delinquency.
I wasn't thinking about what is proper and what is not proper. There was something that I had on my mind. I was speaking for the people whom I am involved with, not only in Watts, but across the country. And when it comes to speaking my mind, protocol becomes secondary. As long as I did not use language that was offensive to anyone, I saw no reason or any fault in the way I handled myself.
Famous baby doctor Benjamin Spock was sentenced to serve 2 years in jail on charges of conspiracy to counsel young men to violate draft laws.
I don't feel like a martyr at all. I don't think I've ever been a martyr, and I don't feel like a martyr now. I think I'm more of a fighter, and I certainly have no inclination to stop fighting right now. I think we've only just begun.
There were demonstrations against anti-war demonstrators. In New York City, a Loyalty Day parade intended to show support for the American soldiers in Vietnam.
Very good demonstration here, the loyalty to our government, and we're very happy with the turnout.
Never have I seen anything like it. I have never seen anything like we've got today.
I think that they should not be allowed because they're all scared to go to Vietnam. And that's as far as I'm concerned. I'm going to go when I'm called, and I don't think I should die for people like this that won't go. They're all a bunch of communists, and they're all just trying to take over the country. They're a bunch of chickens.
In 1968, Pope Paul VI issued an encyclical to Roman Catholics. In it, he upheld the prohibition of all artificial means of contraception. Many Catholic priests throughout the world were displeased with the announcement, forcing the hierarchy of the Catholic Church to institute disciplinary action against some of the dissenting clergymen. A garbage strike in New York City left debris uncollected for almost 10 days, making parts of the city a veritable garbage dump scene. There were more teacher strikes in 1968. In Florida, the nation's first statewide strike kept more than 40% of the Florida teachers home. The longest teacher strike, and one of the most difficult to understand, was the strike of teachers in New York City in the fall. The dispute kept 1 million children out of school most of the fall session. A nationwide strike of telephone operators had supervisors and executives running the nation's switchboards for a few days, and there were some very interesting results. In Vietnam, the Tet Offensive, the Battle of Khe Sanh, the peace talks, and the bombing halt captured the headlines during 1968. The fighting in the streets of Saigon during the New Year, or Tet Offensive, made the war too real for UPI reporter Bill Riley.
A young Negro man, his head wrapped in a bandage, a combat bandage, being helped across the road now. Three others went out ahead of him. They're pulling, telling them, come on, come on. They're about 100 feet from me. They're one, two more wounded. Three, four, five. Coming out, just barely making it to the walls around the villa. The helicopter circling off, one man trips over a piece of debris at the outside of the alley, at the end of the alley.
We'll be right back with the United Press International 1968 News and Review and the story of Vietnam. These are the sounds of war in Vietnam. They are sounds that become dreadfully familiar to American soldiers in Khe Sanh, Hue, and to reporters like Bill Riley in Saigon.
The alleyway, where I can see now, just outside the side gate of the Joint General Staff of the South Vietnamese Command, is littered with bodies
to the unit,
stretchers, and a burned-out truck that carried in military policemen early in the morning. It looks like a scene from World War II is depicted on the... Here comes one of the fire teams we have to get down now.
UPI reporter Bill Riley was describing the scene in Saigon at the beginning of a Viet Cong major offensive. By American estimates, the offensive was a major military defeat for the communist-supported troops. For UPI audio newsman Roger Norum, 1968 in Vietnam meant his first look at death. Norum arrived in Vietnam in March. 2 months later, he and UPI photographer Charlie Eggleston were scampering from building to building covering the fighting just outside of Saigon.
Oh, no. No! Charlie's been shot. Oh, my God. My God, he's... and killed. Oh, my God, blood is streaming out of his nose and mouth. He's got it right in the head. Oh, Jesus.
More of the story of Vietnam and a hope for peace coming up on United Press International's 1968 in Review. The night President Johnson said he would not seek re-election in 1968, he made another announcement.
Tonight I have ordered our aircraft and our naval vessels to make no attacks on North Vietnam. The area in which we are stopping our attacks includes almost 90% of North Vietnam's population and most of its territory.
This action paved the way for preliminary peace talks to begin. After some haggling about where the peace talks would take place, Paris was finally selected, and on May the 13th, the talks began.
America's chief negotiator at these Vietnam talks, Averell Harriman, is certainly not optimistic about any speedy agreement to end the fighting. In a sidewalk news conference, the presidential envoy was asked how long he expected to remain here in Paris.
I did make a speculation when I went to Moscow for the test ban agreement that I thought it would take us 10 days to come to agreement. We came to agreement on the 10th day, but I wouldn't want to make any such prediction this time.
During the summer, the talks appeared to get nowhere. It was not until Halloween night when the president announced a full bombing halt of North Vietnam that any progress was made. The South Vietnam government, after initially refusing to enter the talks at this stage, did agree to meet in Paris, and the hope for peace in Vietnam was encouraged. On January 22nd, North Korean sailors boarded and seized the USS Pueblo, an American intelligence ship which was sailing in the Sea of Japan. The 83 crewmen were taken to North Korea as prisoners and were accused of sailing their ship in North Korean waters. The furor in Congress was overwhelming, but the answers to the solution of the problem were mixed. Two of the views that showed how widely opinions differed were from Representative Mendel Rivers and Senator Gail McGee.
We should demand its return immediately, along with an ultimatum. And the President of the United States should make this demand, in my opinion. Of course, I'm not telling him how to run his office. Now, if they fail to deliver this ship and its crew at the appointed hour, I would be positive, were I the President, that one of their cities would disappear from the face of the earth and do it.
Let's not panic till we know all of the facts. There's been too much popping off first and thinking later, and I don't believe our times permit that kind of irresponsibility. This is the time to keep our cool. We've had a lot of incidents in the Cold War, and in a nuclear age, we cannot risk the folly of spasmodic response to aggravating incidents.
The question never answered thoroughly for some was whether or not the ship had been seized illegally. The United States maintained that the Pueblo was in international waters. This is a direct refutation to the Korean reply that they seized the ship only because it encroached their water boundary lines. At the United Nations, the United States ambassador position was held by three persons during 1968. First, Arthur Goldberg resigned from the post to enter private law practice.
President Johnson has very considerately acceded to my wish to be relieved of my assignment as United States representative to the United Nations. If during the past 3 years my service in this post has been of any use in advancing the cause of world peace, that service will have been worthwhile.
His place was taken by George Ball, former Undersecretary of State. Ball lasted 5 months and then he too quit to campaign for Vice President Humphrey. The current ambassador is J. Russell Wiggins, a former Washington editor and a close friend of President Johnson. To fill the vacant Secretary of Defense spot left by Robert McNamara late in 1967, President Johnson appointed Clark Clifford. After Chief Justice Earl Warren submitted a short note of resignation, the president moved to promote Justice Abe Fortas to the spot. Republicans accused the president of cronyism and political favoritism and held up on approving his recommendation. To put an end to the debate and criticism, Abe Fortas finally announced he would withdraw his name from being considered for the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. In 1968, Russia ruffled her feathers and showed her power to the rest of the world when in August she and members of the Warsaw Pact invaded the country of Czechoslovakia.
We just came over the border, and while we were in Bratislava, we saw some shooting going on. I was standing on top of the Comenius University, and there were maybe a couple thousand people burning this huge canvas. And then they rolled it up and burned it, and a tank went over it, and it was spinning over it, and then some shots. And I went inside, and some bullets came right over my head, about 3 or 4 feet over my head. And then I fled away, and as soon as I was inside, I saw that they were carrying this boy of about 20 years old, and he was all over his stomach. It was all blood and everything. It was just terrible.
The story of the Russian invasion of Czechoslovakia is next on the United Press International 1968 in Review. It was mid-afternoon when the rumble of Russian tanks broke the silence of the streets of Prague, Czechoslovakia, on August 20th, 1968.
On the streets of Prague is a strange paradox, really. There are tanks all over the city. They seem to concentrate in the center of the city at a place called Wenceslas Square. And the odd thing is that people habitually mill around this square in quiet times, and today they're just milling around. The women are carrying children, they're walking their dogs. They stand and watch as the tanks go by. The young people hoot at the tanks, and they boo and whistle and jeer. And I saw one young man carrying they carry many Czechoslovakian flags. I saw one young man take his flag and stick it into the tank's track, and it shoots the flag up. People, they don't really look at the tank. As the tanks roll up the square, the people will stand in front of it and sort of look to one side and pretend it's not there and just step out of the way just in time for the tank to roll by, and tanks don't slow down.
Since early in the year, the Czech government had been aggravating the Russians with announcements of liberal reforms. Reforms that, by Russian standards, were inconsistent with the communist way of political life. Russia warned them that they would not accept these changes. A summit meeting was held in July. The Czechs came from the meeting optimistically with plans to continue their reforms. But little did they know that Russia had other plans. United Press International's News of 1968 will continue right after this message. Reports from Prague throughout the siege made constant reference to the courageous defiance to the Russian military might by the Czech people, especially the young Czechs.
The old people would argue with the Soviet bus, the truck drivers and the tank drivers, but the young people, they were the ones who were trying to instigate these blockades and harassment of any kind, anything that was available, they used. Young kids, 10 years old, 12 years old, the young kids would get right close to the tanks with bricks, and you just fling them at the tanks. And we learned later, although we didn't see it happen, that a Russian soldier was shot from the State Bank of Czechoslovakia, from the roof, and this Russian soldier was killed, lying on the pavement, and they opened up a barrage of fire on the wall of the bank, and the bullet holes all through the windows and the side of the bank.
The Russians eventually pulled most of their troops from the country, but not until Czech leaders promised to adopt unpopular measures that would at least slow down the liberal reform of their country. The wonders and the mysteries of space had mystified man even before Galileo first peered at the stars with a crude telescope. Jules Verne's fictitious voyage to the moon tempted the imagination of men for 100 years. In 1968, that voyage became more of a reality. Americans and Russians proceeded quickly during 1968 to complete the last lap of the 10-year-old race to the moon. For America, it was the Apollo program that provided the drama this year.
5, 4, 3, 2...
There's ignition! Look at the flame pour out from the bottom of those 8 engines.
A huge orange cloud, as usual, billowing up, and you can hear the newsmen applauding in the background as the Saturn 1B lifts off 534. A brilliant flame shooting down as it climbs ever so slowly up into the sky. Listen to the roar.
The mission of Apollo 7 was 11 days long. Commander of the capsule, astronaut Wally Schirra, told what the major goal of the flight was.
The flight is a low Earth orbital mission concentrating on the life support systems, the propulsion systems, and the control systems. Now, in order to do this, we will fly what we call an open-ended flight. What this means is we will allow the flight to continue as long as safety and the consumables on board allow. The limiting one is the oxygen available to the flight crew.
While in space, astronauts Schirra, Cunningham, and Isley broadcast in classic show business tradition the first live television show by Americans from space.
Now you're picking up. I can read it now. Just a minute. It says from that lovely Apollo something. You guys should write high atop something. Looks good. I can see Wally Hamlet now. And Don has a smile on his face, and there's Walt. Okay, what's the next one? A little closer, Wally. Says keep those cards coming. Keep those cards and letters coming in, folks. It's loud and clear.
It was Apollo 7 that made way for Apollo 8, the flight around the moon. Major space accomplishments by Russia in 1968 made them ready to land a man on the moon. So it's clear that 1969 may be the year that someone finally does achieve this goal. The only question remaining is, who will it be, Russia or the United States? It's hard to believe that the first heart transplant took place at the end of 1967, because since that time there have been over 90 transplants made, and almost half of that number are surviving. A nuclear submarine can stay submerged for many days, and they often do. So when the nuclear sub Scorpion had not been heard from for 2 or 3 days, the Navy was not overly concerned. However, a search was begun, and finally they admitted the search had been in vain.
One of the most extensive air and surface searches ever conducted has been made along Scorpion's route. In addition, a wide area on either side of her track has been under continuous search from the air. As a result of this exhaustive coverage, we have determined that Scorpion is not on the surface in a disabled condition.
Perhaps the most tragic story of the year was the one of thousands of starving children in Biafra, the section of Nigeria that has been cut off from the world as a result of a civil war in that country. Money was in the news in 1968 from a gold crisis in March to international monetary problems in November. In March, gold speculators forced the price of gold up to new highs, but U.S. persistence to a price hold of $35 an ounce eased the tension and a crisis was averted. But in November, a new money storm hit the shores of the major non-communist Western nations. Hardest hit was France. President Charles de Gaulle's solution called for budgetary cuts and a general program of austerity for his nation. And from a small mining town in West Virginia came the inevitable story that a mine explosion had trapped 78 men in the bowels of the earth. The search for the men was abandoned when rescuers feared further explosions underground would endanger the rescuers. And so the year is ended. How do you measure it? How do you measure tragedy, assassinations, riots and revolt, people at war, black babies with strangely swollen bellies from lack of food? How do you measure the good things, a hope for peace, success in space, new hearts for new life, social justice for the oppressed? How do you measure? United Press International has presented 1968 in review. This program was produced by Stan Sabick. Technical director was Bill Wilson, and this is Ed Cairns.